Today's guest on Medeo Scientific's The Business of LoRaWAN is Dana Myers, CTO of Lamar Inc. and a longtime systems engineer and ham radio operator. Dana brings a rare combination of RF intuition, operating system level engineering experience from his years at Sun Microsystems, and hard-won startup lessons from taking a LoRaWAN product from zero to more than 1,000 deployed motes in the field. In this conversation, we talk about how his background in ham radio shaped his understanding of LoRa before LoRaWAN, the technical and business pivot from a $1,500 Raspberry Pi comm box to low-power LoRaWAN end nodes, what really changes when you scale from one device to hundreds in revenue operation, and why most people misunderstand LoRaWAN as a real-time high-bandwidth network when it's actually built for small amounts of data sent infrequently. This episode is sponsored by the Helium Foundation and is dedicated to spreading knowledge about LoRaWAN. If you'd like to try Helium's publicly available global LoRaWAN for free and support this show, sign up at metsci.show/console. Now, let's dig into the conversation with Dana Myers. Dana, thanks so much for coming on the show. Super excited to have you here.
Well, thank you so much, Nick. I was flattered when you asked. I'm happy to be here. Hopefully, I won't let you down.
I think you're going to crush. I thought we might start with how being a ham radio guy has informed your use of LoRaWAN or RF in general. And do you think that's something that a lot of LoRaWAN folks should explore?
That is an excellent and outstanding question. And that kind of makes you wonder how well you actually know me. Have we met before? Because my initial interest in LoRaWAN in 2017, and it wasn't even LoRaWAN, it was LoRa. I first saw the LoRa radios, you know, Adafruit was selling them on breakouts. And I have props. I mean, here's a feather with one of the Hope RF modules on it. And I thought, wow, spread spectrum, it's chirp. Oh, wow, 900 meg, cool. That's underutilized band. It's a special band. As a radio amateur yourself, you probably also understand it has multiple users and there's a lot of drama potentially playing out there right now.
Sure.
As well. There always has been on 900 meg, but it's more than ever right now. So I initially was interested in LoRa just as a radio nerd, saying, okay, these 100 milliwatt radios with kind of marginal antennas, what can I do with this? And so I actually built, you're going to laugh, I built an EPRS implementation, and I'm trying to remember all the bits I used, but it actually worked and was running on a feather. I had a feather that I just built to send off packets under command, and I drove around, and I actually had it uplinking to the APRS IS. So you could go look on whatever APRS site, you know, in the internet and see me, and these are reports coming in on 900 meg. The just range wasn't great. My antenna was here at the house, and I think I had about 9 or 10 miles of range across the flat. I live adjacent to a marsh. I overlook a marsh. I'm only about 90 feet above sea level, but the marsh is sea level, so it worked pretty well. So that's how I got started. That's what really raised my interest in it, and I had a lot of fun experimenting with it. I was very surprised multiple times at what you could do with that very low power radio. In particular, I know that I went on a drive one time and was driving across a bridge 25 miles from here above water. It's about 200 feet above the water and excellent coverage all across that bridge. And a 100 milliwatt radio, just astounding capability.
It is impressive, yeah, just how far you can go with how little energy.
You know, the processing gain, the coding gain of spread spectrum in general, it's all about spread your energy wide. And then you bring it back. And when you do that, all the narrowband interferers, they go wide, they go away. So they're reduced. So that's, and particularly on 900 meg with so many users, in particular smart meters up here, our utility meters are all chattering away constantly in an actual mesh network. So it works very well in that presence. So,
and maybe that's a nice segue into, you start off with LoRa, at least in 2017. And if we fast forward to today, February 2026, and now you're working, doing a lot of hardware stuff over at Lamar, and you guys have more than one LoRa radio. Can you walk me through what it was like to go from kind of one to 100 and maybe 100 to 1,000?
Well, I'm going to start with going from zero to one.
Okay.
Because that was fun. This was a case of where, so I'm a radio nerd, but I'm also into cooking barbecue and I enjoy wine and we have a wine country here. And I have good friends in the wine country here that I've known for years. And I cook regularly with an association. I'm actually a member of the Sassoon Valley Vintner Brewer Association. I don't grow wine. I don't make wine, but I'm a member of the association. And through that, I got to know a gentleman named George And George had been working for Lamar, or the predecessor to Lamar, Valley Internet, for a number of years. And he kept saying, you got to come meet Ofer. He's doing this great stuff. You got to come meet Ofer. And I, sure. But I had plenty to do and all that. I had a day job. I was at Sun Microsystems from 1993 right up until the acquisition by Oracle in 2010, where I remained on until 2019.
You're on one of their patents, right? One of the Sun patents?
I have a couple.
A couple, okay. More than one.
Yeah, I spent some time in a Java business development, even though most of my time at Sun was doing Solaris operating system development. I was behind getting functional ACPI into the Solaris kernel. And ironically, Intel was our big partner for that back when Intel thought we were a competitor. But, you know, funny how time works out. So without digressing too much there, I had a day job and I was busy and Ofer sounded great, but Well, eventually I was lured in and I started, and this is in 2019. Yeah, late 2019, mid 2019, late 2019. And I started advising and I did this on spec just to help out my friends, you know, thought it was interesting. People that, I mean, on one hand, I got to get paid for the things I do that add value. On the other hand, I don't demand to get paid because oftentimes I, you know, you got to give to the community and you have to become part of it.
There's a lot of fun work to do. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a definite trade-off there. Although I'm definitely not on Reddit doing young people's homework for them, you know, like on, you know, you embedded or our embedded, right? Yeah. So anyway.
You meet Ofer. Yeah.
Yeah. You know well. So I started attending the meetings. And at the time, what became MeterMe, what they were doing was building they called it a comm box. And it was a Raspberry Pi. And I don't know if Ofer described this to you. Maybe he did. So I don't have to rehash that. They're building this big heavyweight thing with a battery in it and solar and RF link, right? So probably Ubiquiti or something like that. And by the time you counted up just the cost of parts, the BOM, the bill of materials, it was like $1,500 to read a water meter. And they were using breakout boards and fly wires and jumpers. And the first long conversation I had with Ofer was, you're doing this wrong. You'll never succeed doing this. And he'd tell me, he goes, well, I tried 15 years ago or 20 years ago and I failed. And I said, yeah, and this will fail too. And because it's too expensive by an order of magnitude. And I said, you know, you're thinking about this. I mean, you know, here he is very successful deploying a wireless ISP, high speed, low latency, a lot of bandwidth, a very, very high quality SLA, service level agreement. And I'm saying, yeah, you don't need that for what we're doing. Let's go the other way. You only need to take a measurement maybe every 2 hours or maybe when it changes or, right? So let's go that way. And at first, there was some sunk cost going on. So here we are talking. This is a business conversation fundamentally, although we're going to nerd out. And so number one, sunk cost. Yeah, we've already invested in this thing. We already had da-da-da-da. So after a while, a few months go by and I did lend them a hand. I did some engineering for them to try to improve this comm box. And in particular, a controller based on an ESP32 to do all the real-time things the comm box had to do without using any real power. And then the comm box could wake up and interrogate the ESP32. And that was successful, but it was still not the right thing. At some point, Ofer says to me, well, see, here, by the way, let me point out, Valley Internet, they deploy a lot of RF point-to-point links, you know, broadband, highly familiar with 900 megahertz networking and how bad it was, how difficult it was, how unreliable it was, how expensive, everything about it was a turnoff. So when I said 900 megahertz, you could just see Ofer, you know, shut down. And I said, no, it's better than that. So anyway, the 0 to 1, I built a simple moat out of, or, you know, end node or moat. I built one out of that kind of stuff.
And for folks who are watching, two things. You and Ofer have used Moat, which I haven't heard before. Maybe it's just my stunning ignorance once again surfacing. I would normally call it a sensor or an end node, but you guys call it a moat. Is there some terminology that I'm missing? Or is
That's actually coming from the LoRa Alliance terminology. That's where I actually learned that from. But back in the official...
Again, my ignorance can be stunning, yeah.
In the official stuff, which will put you right to sleep if you read it.
Yeah. Maybe that's my excuse.
Certainly, you got to read some specs once in a while. And that's where I got that from. And
okay.
We're the only ones. It's an end node. It's not the sensor itself. It's not the thing actually taking the measurement.
Oh, it's the radio that's sending and receiving. Okay.
It's the radio, and the radio has an integrated computer that does that. So anyway, I built one and we bought a MikroTik, you know, WAPLR9, you know, which is their, you know, I don't have one to, I have one here somewhere, but I'm not going to wave it around. Yeah, it's a podcast after all. And we put one of those up on a mountain peak near here where they have one of the Valley Internet radio sites, really easy to do, connected up, there's power, there's Ethernet, boom. And I'm about 10 or 11 miles as a crow flies from that, and not particularly friendly terrain either, although it's on a high peak, but there's still some terrain that might be an issue. And I went down to like a little parking lot near here, and I fired up this thing and connected. And I called up over and said, hey, look, I'm connected. And he said, oh, crap. Right. This was too good. But it meant that now he really did have to make this big pivot that we've been trying to avoid. And the next thing that we discussed was battery life. And I knew and I was confident and comfortable with how the battery life would work. He was not. We started with solar charged lithium ion cells, you know, initially with pouch cells, although cylindrical cells are a better choice. You know, overall, you know, he says it's not going to last. And I said, let's just do an experiment. And I said, I'll just build a test bench that behaves just like a real moat with a real 420 pressure sensor. The way we measure the tank was with a barometric sensor that lives at the bottom of the tank. So just the pressure of the water, you can determine from that and the dimensions of the tank. So I built one and I said, it's got to be realistic. And so I made it take a measurement periodically and like every, I don't know, 5 minutes because I implemented report on change. This was a completely functioning sensor and end node, you know, moat. This was the whole kit and caboodle. And I charged the battery up and I put it in a shoebox and I put it in a closet. And every week we'd have this meeting where we talk about, oh yeah, the battery is at, you know, 92%. And oh, now it's at, you know, 89%. And after about 5 weeks, he said, this is going to work. Let's go. Can you just build one more of those? And I'll try it out on my tank up here. And now right there, we've gone from one to two. We've gone to our first deployed sensor. And right there, I just made a mistake. What did I do? I took the science experiment in the lab and I deployed it to the field. You got to be careful with that. And so what happened after that, of course, is what we deployed 10 more. And now we actually had
10 more science experiments. Okay.
And we did a better job of building them and making them rugged. And George and the team, you know, they were out finding the right enclosures and trying to make them adequately weather resistant. And
IP60 close. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, and there was a real learning curve there. But we fell into the number one trap of a small company that thinks that they're doing something new and innovative. Is you figure you got to build all this stuff yourself. And so that's one of the first lessons I have here is you probably don't. And if you do build something yourself, you have to really add value. It has to be not just a little bit, not just a little better. You really need to be an order of magnitude more functional or better or easier to deploy or something that shows up in your bottom line. So anyway, we were deploying these. We were building them out of the RAK 4631s.
Mm-hmm.
There were some issues with the maturity of the RAK stack at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I decided I wanted to get more control over the firmware stack. And right about then, the RAK 3172, which is based on an STMicro, the single chip STM32WLXX, which, you know, combines both the radio and the MCU on a single chip, reduces the cost. Really a great thing. And I loved it. And it made it really easy because they had a WISP block module that swapped right out. And mm-hmm. So we were able to, and I wrote the firmware for that. I actually revved the whole design to a Gen 2 in probably 3 weeks worth of engineering. And I even tested it. That's the other thing that we'll talk about. And so we ended up deploying hundreds of those. Hundreds. I think we probably deployed easily 500 of these. We had them in revenue operation. Most of them are still out there, still in revenue operation. But almost as soon as I realized what I, you know, created in the lab and then helped it out into the world, you know, I was just reading in Scientific American about reverse DNA. Do you know about reverse DNA?
Nope. Tell me.
So if you reverse the order of DNA, you'll get the same thing. But if it's like a bacteria, your body won't recognize it. None of your immunity will work against it. So I built this reverse DNA thing and I pushed it out of the lab and everyone's infected and their bodies can't fight it. Well, anyway.
I think that's a different podcast.
Yeah, I know. I know. Okay. But I thought that's something like that. It is interesting though.
So, it's great. It's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. So the point is I immediately said, we have to find vendors. And that was a real challenge for us early on, was finding vendors that had the right functionality and the right features, hit the right cost point. You know, I'll name check a few. MileSight, you know, one of our partner vendors, and we still have a lot of, MileSight in the field. They have really improved, you know, from the initial generations we started with, dramatically improved the product, and I can't complain about that. And then, of course, I have more. Dragino, I found very low cost, but the quality is good.
And I think you said they had some excellent documentation, some of the best documentation out there.
Yes, absolutely. They use Wikipedia for documentation, and it's extensive and comprehensive and understandable, and they're great. And in fact, for the podcast people, I'm holding up, or for the audio listeners, I'm holding up an SN50 V3, which is a moat or end node made by Dragino. They were like $60 or $70. I don't know what the tariffs have done to them since. But they make the source code available for that. And you can use that as your jumping off point to build anything you want to build. It uses a different chip. It's like an STM32WL, but it's the Chinese version.
With the ASSR or something?
Yeah, the ARMSTAR. Yeah.
Or ASSR 6601, something like that.
6601, right. And the MCU in that is like a Cortex M4, but it was actually when ARM China was going rogue. It's actually the IP they produced. So. But works great, you know, great battery life. Very much a fan of that. Something else that I'll let you tell people what I'm holding up. You know what that is.
This little field tester.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what that looks like. Yeah.
And 10071, which worked out great.
I got a couple of those around here as well. And would you say there's something that folks get wrong about LoRaWAN pretty consistently? You hit a little piece of it when you're talking about Ofer coming in from his background thinking, okay, 900's a no-go.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you talk about, whether it's ADR or frame counters or whatever, power budgeting, et cetera?
The biggest thing that people get wrong about LoRaWAN consistently, and it's a thinking cap or a mindset, frame of mind, a context, and that is LoRaWAN is slow. It's small amounts of data, infrequently. It is not, you know, it's not that wireless ISP, high bandwidth, low latency, that you can just ping stuff and know that it's online all the time. You know, with LoRaWAN, you got to be okay not knowing for 2 hours whether a moat or an end node is working or not. But at the same time, you tailor the operation of it now to how quickly the thing that you're reading changes. A tank, most of the tanks, so initially are and probably still for water tanks, it's report on change. Once you change a certain amount, I think we sample every 2 or 5 minutes for that. Now that we've gone to Modbus-based sensors, the power consumption is dramatically lower. With 420 sensors, that was a really big battery budget hit. When you think about it, a 420 sensor can use a quarter of a watt just to take a reading. It's drawing a quarter of a watt.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, 20 milliamps at 12 volts minimum. It's 240 milliwatts right there. And it's actually more than that. So every time you turn the sensor on, you're a quarter of a watt. It was hard on the budget. Whereas Modbus, considerably better, low voltage, low current, you're talking tens of milliwatts maybe, and much quicker measurement of the reading. So once we've done that, but what people get, you know, wrong is they think they have to know all the time what something is. You only really need to know when it changes. And for some tanks, water tanks that are out in the middle of a field somewhere, you might only care about it once a day. So you have to go into it with a mindset of how often do I need to know and approach it that way. That is number one area I've seen where people saying, well, I just installed it. I'm not getting readings yet. I said, was it changed yet? No. I would actually say that's the first kind of structural thing you have to do. The other thing too is kind of a mistake we almost made. And I favor simplicity. You'll figure that out about me at some point. Early on, Ofer said, well, how do we do firmware updates? I said, you know what? Firmware is a component soldered onto the printed circuit board. That's our model. And he goes, well, how's that work? You know, what if we wanted it? I said, most of the features and most of the value we add is in the network itself, in the back end, right? We just have a sensor out in the field that's getting data and at whatever rate. Sure, there are parameters we like to change, like how often you take the reading or what the threshold of change is, those things. And sure, and you can do downlinks to tune those in the field. That's fine. But overall, the firmware tested a little more up front. And after that, most of the new features and most of the innovation you're going to do will be in your back end and what you do with the data. That's been our approach. So don't feel...
Just make it stable and then let it rip.
Right. Now, there is a firmware update over the air spec for LoRaWAN, which, if I understand correctly, is a multicast type approach. It's kind of like the way cable boxes or satellite boxes used to get firmware updates a little bit at a time over a period of time, right? And sure, we've not deployed that. It actually requires a fancier network than we've deployed. I haven't even talked about our network yet. But that's okay.
I mean, you guys are doing some really cool stuff with updates and onboarding and all the rest of it, Ofer was telling me.
Right. So that's another podcast you can go into. I can tell you all the depth about that you'd like, but the biggest adoption problem we've had is it's not you or and it's not me that are installing these things most of the time. It's somebody who is more accustomed to installing a pump motor, right? And getting the red wires where they go and the black wire and the white wire, right? And not that they're not smart. They're just not trained.
Different area of expertise, yep.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know the first thing about drilling a well, or maybe I know the first thing now. But I didn't.
Got to start digging, yeah.
Yeah, well, you have to, it's a drill, actually. Then you have to put a, anyway, then you have to drill another well, the sensor tube. Anyway, there's a lot of fun stuff I've learned. But the point being, you know, we don't have to, we found we could not require our field partners, our channel, to actually know all the technology. That so many moats, you've configured a lot of things. You open the book up and it says, set this to that. Oh, what's your uplink time? You know, and here's your dev UI, and right? And put in the, you know, whatever, if you're LNS and, you know, your network key. And
it has an app key, and that one needs an app UI, and this one needs a join UI. It is like a
right.
Constant, like, please, could you just make this simple?
It was crucial to take that out of the loop and make it where someone could just, with a phone app, ideally with no connectivity, because a lot of our, I mean, that's the point of LoRaWAN. You don't have any, you know, cellular connectivity where you are, although that may get better with the Starlink, non-terrestrial. But anyway, so that's been the big push to drive adoption, make it possible to be adopted.
And that came through super strongly. The Ofer conversation hasn't gone public at the time that you and I are recording this, but it comes through really strongly for folks who have listened to it, that he's just hell-bent on making sure this is super easy. He calls it friendlifying, but just making it easy.
We have to trademark that. Like, well,
yeah. Well, you got more important things to protect.
Yeah.
Let's wrap this thing up. You've been doing this for a while. You've been in game for a long time. If some young pup is coming along and getting into LoRaWAN, what advice might you give them?
Well, that's a good question. It's probably more the generic advice for almost any field, almost any path you go into. Do your homework, take your time to learn who your customers are, learn what your application is. It's easy to come in thinking what it is and driving aggressively toward a goal that you have in your head and then find out maybe it's not the same one your customers have. I mean, I think we experienced that a little bit in this case. So number one, take the time to get to know your market, your customers. You know, I don't want to be careful about this. Don't be afraid to fail, but don't set out to fail. A friend of mine, Jeff Rothschild, I don't know if you know him. Jeff, he and I worked together decades ago, and he went on to found some companies and did Veritas among them and did very well and went on to, he was the adult supervision on a round of funding to Facebook because he was part of Excel Partners at the time. And so yeah, Jeff and Zuckerberg hit it off, and Jeff ended up retiring from Facebook, retiring a second time, this time from Facebook. And Jeff will tell you, as a serial entrepreneur himself, he'll say, don't be afraid to fail and fail fast. So, and I'd pass that advice along, and he's been way more successful than I have, that don't be afraid to fail, but do your best not to start with, and pay attention, be honest with yourself, that this isn't working. I'm not achieving these goals. You know, the sunk costs, don't just keep, if I just work harder, if I just work longer, if I just do more of the same thing that's not working, oh, I'm sure that'll work out, right? So you have to be honest with yourself on that. And that's in any business, you know, with LoRaWAN, we've been successful so far. We'd like to be a lot more successful. And that's exactly the way we approached it.
Gripping. Well, Dana, I appreciate you taking time on a Friday afternoon. I know I have to clear this for the higher authority. So thank you for making time for me.
She went shopping. She's gone. No, anyway. Yeah, my pleasure.
That's it for this episode of The Business of LoRaWAN. If you want to go deeper and actually deploy devices, the Medio Scientific Console is the fastest way to do that. And honestly, it's also the best way to support the show. When you use the console, you're not just listening, you're participating in the same real-world LoRaWAN work we talk about here every week. You can get started with a free trial at medioscientific.com. Huge thanks to the sponsor of this show, the Helium Foundation, for supporting open LoRaWAN infrastructure worldwide. Check them out at helium.foundation. And if the show's been useful, a quick rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to this really helps people find it and helps the show grow so we can help more people. I'm Nick Hawks with Medio Scientific. I'll catch you on the next episode.